Okay, and so we are back with After Dark episode for patrons on Patreon only, and I suppose you know that if you're listening to this, so what am I telling you that for?
That or they're bootlegging it.
Yeah, right, they're bootlegging it.
Yeah.
We found this on a torrent site.
Look,
or something.
If you're bootlegging these episodes, you know, congratulations.
Yeah, you win. You can have
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you've won.
Yeah. Yeah. We're following up with this great conversation we've been having with Hegulian regarding Franz Kafka. And as promised, I want to just get into a couple of things, but we don't have to talk about just this. We can kind of go anywhere, but I do think it's interesting. The one thing I wanted to bring up, not just to be scandalous, but it turns out that Franz Kafka most likely had a son that he didn't know about. And why I think this is relevant is in a lot of Kafka's writing, we have this perspective of him as this sort of dark, if you haven't read any of it, you can have this perspective of him as this sort of dark, pale figure scribbling away in a basement and, you know, sort of nihilistic and all of that. But the truth of the matter is somewhere a little bit sunnier and more optimistic than that. He desperately wanted to be married, to have a family, to have children, to be a father. And this idea that he had a child with a woman that he had a very brief affair with, which is apparently the story, that the child was born and that due to World War One, the goings on of World War One, this affair, the woman that he'd had this affair with never gave him this information, never got in touch with him and let him know that he had a son. And then that this son actually died around the age of 10 or 12 years old, which would be sort of Kafka's right, you know, heir. Now this was mentioned in the Max Brod biography, but then later it kind of came out that some additional follow-up investigation suggested that this woman who's known only as M. in the in sort of archival material, that she may have made it all up. So it's a little uncertain. Max Brod tended to think that yes, this woman had given birth to Kafka's son, and then other people sort of involved in this fear believed that she actually hadn't. Now here's where it gets even stranger. Stranger or sadder or makes more sense. I'm not sure. In our Kafka biography episode, we learn that almost all of Kafka's surviving family members, after his passing, were killed in the camps during World War II. You know, these were German speaking Czech Jews who were rounded up, and most of them lost their lives in the camps. The story goes that this M.M., the mother of Kafka's purported child, had been beaten to death by a German soldier during World War II. So I guess I just say this all for more biographical context, but there's something about, I'm fascinated with this idea of to what extent did Kafka understand World War II coming? I feel like he did in a certain way. And maybe I'm granting him too much. Maybe I'm trying to turn a guy who's just a brilliant guy into some kind of, you know, visionary. But I feel like he predicted, at least thematically, a lot of the 20th century that came after his life. And I feel like he must have seen that coming. I don't know. That's an interesting sort of factoid about his life, or at least I thought it was interesting.
It is interesting, I think. And, the sort of relationships with women do feature quite a bit in his novels, you know, The Trial and The Castle.
Yes.
But they are usually kind of rather fleeting. Mm-hmm. There is the Frieda, the sort of bar girl, mm-hmm. in The Castle, who he gets engaged to. Rather, it's kind of instantly, really, after one night.
Yeah.
But this relationship kind of gets scuppered, really, later on. And there are a number of girls, I think, in the trial, for which this is something I noticed watching this film, actually yesterday with my wife, rewatching it, you know, the Orson Welles film, was the number of kind of, you know, amorous encounters in this film that Joseph K. has, which, of course, are kind of frustrated, you know, that being the nature of the novel. But yeah, I mean, I think he was, Kafka was, you know, he was a handsome fella, and I think he had some success with the ladies, but...
yeah, I think he did. And he was a romantic too.
Yeah,
to a certain extent. And I believe it's been published in a single volume. His letters to Melina. I'm not going to remember, or even if I remember to be able to pronounce her last name. But one of his love affairs, which was mostly by correspondence, and they're I've read some of these letters, and they're beautiful. I mean, you have to put them in the context that they're love letters to a person rather than trying to read. If it was a book of poetry or something, it might be a little maudlin. But if you read them as letters to an actual person, they're beautiful and touching, you know? And
I think, you know, seeing Kafka as some sort of incel is quite wrong.
I agree. I agree. And that's one of the things we definitely tried to do in our first episode was kind of show why that myth might persist, but also kind of break it apart a little bit.
Well, and we named the episode Franz Kafka, Kafka Goes to Hot Topic. And we know that incels really didn't go to Hot Topic. Hot Topic is where you went to get some sweet pleather pants. I mean, you were going to the show.
Yeah. Hagulian, I don't think, did they have Hot Topic on your side of the pond? I don't think so.
Maybe. I think in Britain, but not in Poland.
Yeah, not in Poland.
But I think, you know, like eroticism in Kafka is a whole topic in itself, I think.
Sure.
But in terms of Jewishness, I mean, that's interesting that Kafka never mentions Jews or Judaism or Jewishness, none of these things in his novels, but he does mention those things in his diaries.
Yeah.
He was interested in those things and the so-called Jewish question. And, you know, and this was being talked about a great deal, of course, in the early 20th century, especially in the German-speaking world and countries where, you know, large numbers of Jews live, for example, Poland, where I am. Mm-hmm. And obviously there was some kind of threatening, you know, kind of undertone to that. And Kafka also talks a bit of it in his diaries about Zionism. You know, there was a kind of widespread idea, you know, we'd be better off going to Israel.
Yeah.
Of course, it was still Palestine at that point.
Right. And Max Brod, his close friend and literary exeter, would end his life in Jerusalem. There's an interesting... Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, no. I just wanted to ask Hagulian about, you know, Kafka's Jewishness and this notion of the law being so central in his thinking too, right? Do you think there's some corollary between those two things?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, his father is, of course, a hugely important influence, and his father did, you know, sort of drag him along to the synagogue, basically. You know, he didn't really want to go. But, you know, that the fact that Judaism is, you know, both based around those commandments, of course, as Christianity is, and these are essential, really, you know, to the faith, the whole idea of the law, you know, that God's word is a law. Yeah, and this is not, you know, necessarily the case in all religions, you know, so pagan religions, for example. And of course, he studied law, right, at university.
Mm-hmm.
He had a law degree. And he was living, you know, in a society which was much more formal than ours today.
That's true.
This is one wonderful thing about Metamorphosis, I think, where, you know, he wakes up as the bug, and he's late for work, of course, and his office manager comes along, doesn't see him as the bug at the to begin with.
Yeah.
But
oh, that's my favorite. That's actually the most horrifying part of that story to me. The bug start waking up as a bug is yeah. bad, but your boss yeah. showing up. At right. your house is,
yeah. And he's thinking, maybe I can catch the 8 o'clock train.
Right. Right.
But the scandal, you know, the scandal of being late.
Right.
And his family are just aghast, you know, at this, yeah. they don't know what's happened to him at that point, of course. But they're right. just horrified that he's you know, his manager has turned up and he's late, and it's a true scandal, you know. So it was a much more formal society in those days. Of course, Kafka finds this kind of amusing, clearly. But the law features so much in. I think, you know, we can look at the Book of Job, you know, for some kind of parallel to Kafka, especially things like the trial. You know, this kind of feeling of persecution. Now, there's something that Walter Benjamin wrote about Kafka. Where was it? About original sin. But Benjamin wrote some pieces about Kafka about 10 years after his death. Of course, Benjamin himself, a German Jew, just a bit younger than Kafka.
Oh, wait, so this is, he was writing about 10 years after his death.
Right, yeah.
So he's somewhat of an early Kafka adopter, I guess.
I think he was, I think he was great, you know, very a big admirer of Kafka. And, you know, obviously they shared quite a lot of affinities, really. So Benjamin writes this, that Kafka gives a kind of definition of original sin. I'm not sure where this comes from. It doesn't say in the piece by Benjamin, but original sin, the old injustice committed by man, consists in the complaint unceasingly made by man that he has been the victim of an injustice, the victim of original sin. So it's a bit sort of circular.
Right.
So, and he, this is in this section of the piece, of Benjamin's piece, he's kind of connecting that to the father and that the figure of the father as a kind of punisher. As a law, basically, you know, he represents the law,
right? Right.
Yeah.
And Kafka had that sort of famously challenging relationship with his father, sort of admiring him and wanting to be like him, and disappointing him, and kind of hating him in a certain way, and right.
Yes.
So to sort of sublimate that to his relationship with the law, both. You know, societal and cosmic makes sense. I mean, we probably all do that to a certain extent, you know?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I was listening to The Judgment today, actually.
Yeah, it's great.
Which is all about a young man and his father, really. Clearly, you know, the young man is avatar for Kafka. But in this, I think he's a kind of young businessman who's kind of taking over his father's business, which I think Kafka himself had something like that happening. Who writes? He talks about writing to an old friend of his who's living in Russia, who went to live in Russia and started up a business, which is rather, you know, kind of unsuccessful in Russia. Mm. But what was his name? Was it George? I can't remember the name of the character. But anyway, he says he's just got engaged, but he's not sure whether he should tell his friend in Russia, you know, about this, because it's just kind of flaunting his success against his, you know, over his friend's failure and so on. But anyway, he later ends up in a kind of an argument with his father, and the father in the story is kind of a decrepit old man, really, who needs to be helped, you know, into bed, and the covers have to be put on him and so on. And this father, though, clearly commands a lot of authority over his son, even though the son is his carer, essentially. It's a fascinating story. And again, I'm not going to give away the ending.
Fair enough. Yeah.
One thing I wanna... well, there we go. We got the jinx there, Brad. I was going to say, as I'm sitting here listening to all this, I'm thinking about Kafka and his act of writing and what his act of writing might have been like. And I feel like he was somebody who was painfully aware of how onanistic and strange the act itself can be, and how miserable it is to write. There's this sort of strange, it really is a misery in many cases. You isolate yourself. If you're going to be writing a novel, you do sort of transform into a bug in a certain certain sense. Yeah. And yeah, I feel like that.
To a certain degree, it's compulsive. I don't know if it's compulsive is the right word, but you've enslaved yourself to a process.
Again, you reminded me of something Baudrillard said in one of his books of Fragments, which he says writing is an inhuman and unintelligible activity.
that's what I'm going to tell people when they ask me what I do. Instead of saying writing, I engage in an inhuman,
unintelligible.
Yeah, I engage in an inhuman and unintelligible activity. You don't want to know about it.
This is one of the reasons I write plays, for what it's worth, because when we're done with the actual script, we've just started. So
right.
Personally.
Right, yeah. Then you get to share the misery with some other people.
I mean,
precisely.
It does feel strange. I mean, cause you're kind of sort of putting your views out of your opinions or you're just your crazy visions or whatever.
Yeah.
And you have to have some kind of, I don't know, almost create a psychotic belief in yourself.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You know, the this is kind of odd, but
it's delusional in a good way. I mean, I'm glad that there are so many delusional people out there, but I know for me as a writer, it's clearly like, yeah, I believe in it, whether for no good reason, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
Because I have to, because if I don't, then I don't do it. And you know, it's a necessary part of the process is believing in it.
Yeah, Ballard said, much like Cameron actually, but I think even more so, that he didn't enjoy it, right? He wanted to be a painter, really. He always wanted to be a painter, but he didn't have the talent.
Yeah.
And but he felt this compulsion, you know, this enormous compulsion to write what was going on in his head, you know, write it down. So there's kind of no choice in a way.
Yeah. I definitely don't enjoy it. The process is not enjoyable. I do enjoy the occasional time where I read back over something and I think it's good, though. There's very little, and it's not like this happens often, but there's very little. And I imagine Kafka must have felt this way too, because he believed in his own writing to a certain extent, I think more than the myth of him portrays. But there, I know that every once in a while when I read back something and it sort of meets my own standards, that is one of the best feelings in life. Right. Just like, oh, that is a good page. Like that page is checking all of the boxes for what I wanted it to be. And so you write for the glory of that, you know, couple of minutes, I suppose.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think if it's just in your nature to do this, you just have to accept it, right?
Yeah.
Get on with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's in my nature, you know, to put my thoughts out there.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. That's what we're all, you know, we're all doing on Twitter as well, yeah, right?
I don't really question it. I just do it, you know.
Yeah. It is one of those things. I think it's if you look at it too closely, you end up having like an Elmer Fudd walking off the cliff moment. Where, like, if you look down, you will fall. But as long as you don't look down, you're all right.
That's right. I had one of those moments yesterday, actually, where I went to put my wallet in my pocket, my trouser pocket, and I couldn't remember which pocket I usually keep my wallet in.
Left or right. right. That's a very that's a little mini Kafka-esque moment too. I think that's a feeling that I could see him expanding into a short story.
Looking like a baseball manager doing that number.
Right. You're feeling everything. Yeah.
You buy a new coat.
Yeah. Well, one thing I want to hit on just before we wrap up, I found this interesting that the legacy. The Kafka legacy. So the famous story, which is fundamentally true, is that Kafka gave his papers to Max Brod and told him, Max Brod, to burn them. And I personally think that Kafka probably winked when he said it. But we all know Max Brod did not burn them and instead put the time and effort and energy into putting a lot of this work out in, you know, publishing it. And that's why without Max Brod's efforts, you know, all this work would have been lost. But what's interesting is kind of what happened after that. So Max Brod had this, he befriended this couple, the Hoffs, in Israel, and in particular had a relationship with Esther Hoff, who became his secretary and possibly his lover. And Esther, and he gave the papers to Esther Hoff, the Franz Kafka manuscripts to Esther Hoff, and the original German, you know, what Kafka actually physically wrote. And he told Esther to basically give them to Israel, right? And she didn't. She hung on to him. She hung on to him for years. In fact, she would later sell the original trial manuscript for like $2 million sometime in, I think, the 90s. But the Israeli Supreme Court deemed that the Kafka manuscripts belonged to the state of Israel. Apparently, there is this thing called the Israeli Archives Law of 1955, which is relevant to documents and artifacts, which, irrespective of where they are found, are deemed relevant to the study of the nation's history, its people, the state, and society. And now, Kafka's work in the original German is now in the public domain, so this isn't such a big deal in terms of who gets the money and all of that. But I just thought it was very interesting that the Israeli government deemed that, like, the work of Kafka is sort of like state property, is part of the story of the Jewish people, if you will. And apparently this was embroiled in like a long, complicated legal battle, partially complicated by the fact that, well, no, Kafka didn't have any heirs or anything, right, to share this with. So it's sort of like, who does it belong to? But it's interesting that Kafka, who was a Jew and thereby a Jewish writer, but who, on the face of it, I mean, I didn't really even, I think when I was, you know, a teenager reading Kafka, I didn't have any sense that he even was a Jew. He was just some kind of weird Czech guy to me, you know?
Right.
Yeah. It makes me wonder what else, I guess, is in this archive of stuff that the Israeli government has obtained. So I just thought that was kind of interesting that it's interesting that Kafka's work gets embroiled in this complicated, spiraling, sort of unclear labyrinth of legal.
Perfect.
Right. It's the last trial.
It reminds me of reminds me of Hemingway and Hemingway's final wife, Mary, who went back to the house in Cuba. And she was feted by Castro and all the dignitaries down there. And they took, you know, they oversaw her visit back to the finca outside of Havana. And there was a moment where she asked Castro for the art. There was a bunch of number of paintings and things from his Paris days that would be quite valuable now. And Castro put his hand on her shoulder and said, "They belong to the Cuban people now." They nice. Mean it. They right. meant it. Right. So yeah. Right. And literary estates are hotly contested. That's a whole world of its own. Yeah. I didn't know that. And so they must be what, in an archive in Tel Aviv or something like that?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, the original German works are now in the public domain. So a lot of the translations aren't yet in the public domain. So I think now with it being in the public domain, there's not as much to fight over, really, right?
Uh-huh. But the papers and the letters and things will still be that, you know, they have archival value. Yeah. Right. So when I want to write Metamorphosis, the musical,
right?
With a
Metamorphosis and zombies or whatever.
Yeah. We can do that and keep the
but
rights.
It's got to be in. It's got to be in German, though.
Oh yeah, wunderbar.
Yeah.
Okay, now.
Yeah.
Well, so I didn't want to wind down, but Hegulian, was there anything, I know you did preparation for this, and I wanted to make sure that we didn't miss any particular thing you were enthusiastic about talking about. Is there anything that you feel like we should talk about?
Actually, just maybe one story I didn't mention.
Okay.
Which I actually posted on Twitter today or retweeted.
Oh yeah, I've never read that. So tell us about that.
That's called The Householder's Concern. It's a very, very short story, actually. Just a couple of pages. And it's one of my favorites, in fact, because it's just a very odd little thing about a sort of creature, really, which is a sort of imaginary creature, which is called a Dradek. And maybe the best thing is just to describe a Dradek as it appears in the book, really. So it looks at first glance like a flat, star-shaped spool. It even appears to be wound with thread, or rather with a lot of old odds and ends of thread knotted together, some of them tangled together and comprising a great variety of types and colors. But it is not just a spool, because projecting from the center of the star is a little rod forming a cross piece with another little rod extending from it at right angles. By means of this latter rod on one side and one of the rays of the star on the other side, the whole structure is able to stand upright as if on two legs. And as it goes on to say, Dradek is quite exceptionally nimble and there is no catching him. And he sort of speaks as well. He seems to just sort of hang around the narrator's house. and he says, what's your name? One inquires. Dradek, he says. And where do you live? No fixed abode, he replies with a laugh. But it is only the kind of laugh that can be produced without lungs. It sounds something like the rustle of fallen leaves. So it's just a little, I don't know, vignette really of this thing which has some kind of existence.
There's almost a Lovecraftian vibe, but without the menace, maybe, or without as much menace to it.
Yeah. There isn't a kind of overt menace. The story ends on a kind of like a negative note where it says, clearly he does no one any harm, yet the idea of his outliving me on top of everything else is one I find almost painful to contemplate.
Poor Franz Kafka. That's cool. I don't know how I never came across this story before. Kafka's one of these people who I feel like I've read exhaustively, and then stuff just keeps popping up here and there.
Is Lovecraft the Kafka of America, or is Kafka the Lovecraft of Europe? I think this is an interesting,
is an interesting point. They're closely related in age. I mean, Lovecraft was born in 1890. Kafka was born in 1878 or something like that. So they're not that far apart. It's interesting. We might have to talk about, we are doing an H.P. Lovecraft episode in March. So I'm in H.P. Lovecraft brain at the moment. So maybe everything looks like Lovecraft to me.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, it should be good.
And I just watched the first season of True Detective, which of course exists in the Lovecraft world somehow, wonderful. Very strange.
Very interesting.
Well, I want to thank you, Hagulian, for coming on, Brad, and thank you for organizing this. I really enjoyed this.
This is good. This was good for us to get thinking about, you know, about Kafka and thinking about a little bit more deeply. I'm really liking these episodes. We really try to do the biographical stuff, which is great, but getting, you know, smart people on here to help us further understand what the actual art is about is really edifying. So yes, thank you, Hagulian. This was fantastic.
Thank you kindly. It was my pleasure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's it, Kevin.
Yeah, you know who we are. You're on Patreon, or you've bootlegged this. And I guess try not to turn.
I like to think of an active Art of Darkness bootleg.
Somebody's out there burning CDs of every After Dark episode, selling them on the street.
I feel authority. Honored.
Do you want to hear about Kafka, kid? Let's go. Have you ever heard of a Jewish Czech writer from the awesome. ArtofDarkPod.com. We love you.
All right.